Hi, everybody. I am Kathy, and I'm recovering one day at a time in the worldwide Al-Anon family groups. Hi. I would like to thank Harlan and the committee for inviting me back to Seaside, Oregon. It's, well, as you know, because you're here, it's just such a great place, the state of Oregon. I try not to tell people about it because I'm afraid everybody from Ohio will move here and then I'll hate it. And so will you. But I would also like to thank Chris. Chris picked my husband Dan and me up, as well as Vinoy and Mary Alice. And when we came in yesterday, it's amazing because from Portland to here, it was as though we went through four separate climates. I mean, we started out with rain, and then we ran into just driving hail, and then it was snow, and I don't know, then it got sunny. So just so many different ways of seeing Oregon just in that short period of time. One of the reasons I think that I enjoy coming to a place like this so much is because when you are, at least when I am, by an ocean, by mountains, it continues to remind me really how unimportant that I am. You know, it just leaves me with a great sense of humility, as does my Al-Anon program. It just, every day, reminds me of how powerless I am over so many things. I have a sister-in-law who's been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years, 29 years actually. And she told me once that whenever she goes to an AA convention, she always goes to hear the Al-Anon speaker. And I said to her, well, that's really very generous of you. And she said, oh, no, it makes me very grateful I drank. So be that as it may. I think, you know, I've listening to Carla, listening to Billy, it just always strikes me in meetings or just really in the fellowship that these programs of recovery have introduced me to. So much of it really is about telling of stories, you know, the being willing not only to tell your story, but more importantly, being willing to listen. I find being a sponsor involves so much of just being willing to be a good listener to other people. My story really isn't very different from a lot of stories that I've heard over the years. I came from a really wonderful family. I don't know that it was a normal family, but it was very average in many respects. It was, you know, I like to tell people I'm a middle child, out of middle America, born into the middle class. I mean, everything about it was pretty much the same as a lot of the young kids that I grew up with. I mean, we didn't have a lot of differences. One thing that set my family, I think, set it off to the side was my parents were really very, very funny people. My dad is no longer with us. My mother is still alive. And I'm telling you, she'll be 93 next month. She continues to be one of the funniest broads I've ever met in my life. I mean, she just, as did my dad, they just faced life with a great deal of humor and a firm belief that everything in the end would really work out all right. And so that sense of humor and this great faith and the fact that my father had a job, he was always in the news industry. When we were little, he was in radio. He was a newscaster on radio. And as we got older, he was on local TV. And so when his hours were always different. And when we were kids, everything could be disrupted by flood, by, you know, murder, by riot, but whatever it was, my father would have to shoot out of the house. He worked erratic hours. That made us a little different. It also gave, I think, me, as well as my five brothers and sisters, this deep appreciation for, what can I say, not criminals, but this deep appreciation for people who were different, who just, you know, who lived an adventurous kind of life, for people who just did things differently. They didn't divorce their wives. They chopped them up into pieces and put them in a trunk and shipped them to Cleveland. I mean, who thinks like that, you know? The other thing that's, and I don't want to spend too much time, sometimes I look at my watch, I've spent the whole time talking about my family. It was just a wonderful place, I think, to grow up. When I was after I was married and I started to look for help, I went to a social worker one time and she said to me, well, tell me about your family. And I said, my family? She said, yes, tell me about your family, where you grew up and what it was like. And I said, well, I grew up in a great place. I mean, I grew up just, you know, everything that happened was all dealt with humor. There's just a lot of laughing. There was a lot of joy. And she said, that's pretty sick. And I thought, well, maybe so. But as a kid, we really enjoyed it. We had a great time. I love to tell the story about my father. My father had one brother who died suddenly at age 48, massive heart attack. He was typical Irish in the sense that he still lived with his mother, bachelor. But he had one time served as president of the Hibernians, which is this ancient order of, I think they're mainly Irish Catholics in Cincinnati. They always steal this statue of St. Patrick's to this day, right before St. Patrick's Day parade, and then it miraculously appears at the head of the parade. So they really are involved in a lot of pomp and circumstance. So when my Uncle Murray had this massive heart attack and died, the Hibernians took care of the wake, they took care of the funeral, planned the whole liturgy. It was very impressive. When I got to the funeral home, my father was standing in the front of, really, really standing next to his only brother's open casket. And I went up to him and I put my arm on his arm and I said to him, gee, Dad, the Hibernians have done a wonderful job with the wake tonight. I know they're going to do a great job with the funeral mass tomorrow. And my dad, in his grief, turned to me and he said, this is nothing. At dawn, they're going to execute a Protestant. And really, that's how I grew up. I mean, that's the whole thing right there in that story. It just tells the whole deal. My mother continues to be the same way. She just said to me not so long ago at 92, she said, I ran into so-and-so, and my mother is convinced that as women get older, they get just more and more difficult to live with. And she said to me, I just ran into so-and-so. She said, she's the most negative person I've ever met. And I said, well, Mom, you know, maybe she's getting older. Maybe she has aches and pains. She said, that's what everybody says. Everybody says, oh, wait till you get to know her. You'll really like her. I don't have that kind of time. So you take that sense of, you know, always make the best of things, make light of it, everything will turn out okay, and you throw on top of that over 16 years of an education, except for grade school. My high school was all women, my college was all women, and all through those years I was taught primarily by nuns who continued, good nuns. I mean, they were good women that always taught you the importance of putting yourself last, doing for others, the secret of joy, Jesus, others, yourself. I mean, so many of us had that ingrained in us, the importance of suffering, how it would build character, but it had to be silent suffering or it didn't count. And, you know, I saw that hat out there, you know, that says, thou shalt not snivel. I mean, that was also, you know, reinforced at home. We just were never, that whining, self-pity, it just simply was not, I mean, it wasn't tolerated. It just, nobody paid attention to you. I grew up in that era when nobody really, when you were a kid, nobody really cared about how you felt about things. Nobody even asked you. So one day when I was in college and I had been dating just this lovely guy from Indianapolis, just as nice, patient, thoughtful as they come. It was summer, so he was back in Indianapolis. I'm in Cincinnati. And a gal that I knew called me, and she said, my brother is coming into town. He's a Marine. And she said, I have fixed him up with everybody I can fix him up with, and I'm out. I mean, I don't know anybody else to call. I know I don't know you very well, but would you consider going out with my brother? So I thought, well, you know. know, what the heck, I can do that. I mean, it was Vietnam, I wanted to do my patriotic duty. So I said, sure, I'll go out with him. So this guy comes to my door, and I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with Marines, but he was just, you know, just that typical Marine. He had a leather jacket on. He was in, I don't know if he had his wings yet, but he was in pilot training. He was down in Meridian, Mississippi, on his way to Beeville, Texas. And he had on this jacket that had, you know, this patch that said, United States Marine Corps, one good deal after another. And came to the door, and he had this little silver monogrammed cup that was filled to the top with bourbon. And he, you know, for some reason, I just thought that was so, I don't know, slick. And, you know, we went out, and he just seemed to be so sure of himself. And really, this was a time in my life when I was a senior in college. I had no idea what I was going to do next. My dear friend from Indianapolis, he had no idea what he was going to do next. And a lot of times when we would go out, we'd just say, what are we going to do next? I mean, we just, you know, we didn't know what was, we just had no plans. But here's a guy that had plans. I mean, here was a guy that was going to get his wings, it was going to go to Vietnam, it was going to be one good deal after another. And I'll tell you the truth, I was just fascinated by him. I'd never met anybody like that before in my life. The one thing, I mean, he was so dangerous. He used to drive, he just did everything that, to me, seemed to be dangerous. I said to his sister one time, you know, whenever I see him, my heart beats faster, I think I might be in love. She says, that's not love, that's fear. But whatever it was, I liked the guy. He seemed really sure of himself. He was very funny, he was smart, and he was a very, very brave guy. The fact that he had this horrible temper didn't put me off, because I was sure that with a little patience and a little tolerance, a little lot of love, it'd be okay. You know, he would be okay. When he saw how long-suffering I could be, you know, I would just outlast him. And so even though I was in Cincinnati, and then after I got out of school, I went to teach in Chicago, and now, you know, he goes from Beeville to Havelock, North Carolina, or Pensacola was in there somewhere. we were never in the same city. But when we were, I don't know, I mean, we would go on dates that I had never gone on dates like that before. We would go on dates where he would rent a small plane, and we would go up and fly over the Ohio River, and then he would say something like, do you know what a stall is? And I would say, a what? And the next thing I know, you know, we're taking a nosedive towards the river, and then he pulls it up at the last minute. Well, I was just, I mean, I was overwhelmed. I just couldn't believe this. His father used to race quarter horses, so he was really very good with, you know, horses. And he would take, his family lived out on this big spread outside of the city of Cincinnati where they had quarter horses and a lot of room to go riding. And so we'd go horseback riding. And, you know, when I would get off the horse, you know, to open a gate, and the horse would, you know, go like this, whatever you call that, you know, they'd hit you with their nose. He would say to me, punch that horse in the nose. I'd say, what? He'd say, you have to let those horses have to know who's boss. Punch that horse in the nose. I would think, are you crazy? I mean, I could never, I would punch a horse on the nose. I'm a city girl. I can never do that. But I just always felt like he knew what he was doing. He was always so in charge. We went over to Indiana once to ride horses with a big gang of people. And one of these guys from the city, like myself, was in a stall with a horse that must have sensed his fear, and that horse had him trapped in the corner of the stall. And it was a dangerous situation. So the call went out, get Rick, get Rick, get Rick. Well, I'm with Rick. So he, you know, I watch him as he goes in, he vaults over the stall door, and he grabs that horse by its neck, takes its ear, and bites that horse's ear, which paralyzes a horse. as it would me. And and then he saddled the damn thing and, you know, just walked it right out of the stall. And I thought, there's the guy I want to spend the rest of my life with. And what could happen? What could happen that he wouldn't take care of? And so we very quickly decided to get married. Actually, he announced it to his family before I even knew that it was a plan. But, you know, this is me. If I have any addiction, I have an addiction to approval. How things look and being right were always very, very important to me. I don't know how that happened. I wouldn't blame anything on my parents. My parents gave us my parents gave us all this burden of being raised with people with a great marriage. I mean, it was very clear, really, I never saw my parents fight. My father wouldn't fight. He would never fight. He wouldn't even think about fighting. If my mother lost it, as she did, I mean, her parents were from Ireland, she had this bright red hair, and she's got a temper, and she would always say, I wouldn't give you a dime for a man that didn't have a temper. So she would blow up occasionally, and my father would simply say to her, Agnes, come here and let me smother you with kisses. And that would be the end of that. I mean, he wouldn't engage. So it would just be my mother spinning around for a while, slamming cabinets, slamming doors, and that was the end of it. I mean, it never went any further than that. But it was very clear to us as kids that the main relationship in that house was my mother and father, the love affair that they had, and that we were loved, but we always came in second. We always came in second. And I'll tell you, later on, when alcoholism really had our family in the grips of it, I could never make that happen. I always was trying to recreate in my own home what I had grown up with. Because as a kid, I grew up with a great sense of security and a great sense of affection and approval. And I was given all kinds of control over, you know, these little things in my life. And I almost killed myself trying to replicate that for my own children, and I just couldn't do it. There is so much grief associated with the disease of alcoholism. And sometimes, you know, I don't know that we talk about it a lot, but I do, because I think it's important to recognize it. I think it's important to recognize it. My kids, you know, try as I did, and boy, I just put my best efforts into it. I was just talking to one of my girls about this past week. Try as I might, I could not make my household normal for them. Try as I might, I just couldn't do it. It was beyond me. And it was beyond me because you have taught me that I am powerless over this disease. And I was powerless over the effects that it had on my kids and continues to have on my kids. Some of my kids look like they're doing very, very well, but as their mother, I know that some of them live with a deep grief, with a deep grief. And this program is the only thing that I know. It's the only thing that I know that can actually address that, where they have some place to go to tell their story. To tell their story. So, so he made this announcement to his family that we were going to get married. It was an announcement I didn't know, as I said, that he was going to make. I wasn't even really sure that it was the right thing to do, but God forbid that I would say in front of his entire family, what are you talking about? No. Because, you see, it's always easier for me, somebody like me, to let you make the decisions. You take the responsibility, because if everything then blows up in our face, you are the one that made that decision, not me. So it's a really safe, dishonest way to live. But really, from there on in, my work was cut out for me. I tried as best I could to make it look like everything was just fine, that my life was exactly how I wanted it. 10 days after we were married, I knew I was in over my head. And I don't really have time to go into the details, but in a general way, I can tell you this. My first instinct within 10 days was to run. We were living in a trailer in outside Cherry Point, North Carolina, in a little town at the time called Havelock. Town's still there. I don't know how little it is anymore. And one day he came home from work, and I made a run for it, and I just went into the little downtown area, as small as it was, and I remember wandering around inside of a furniture store and thinking to myself, you've got to get out of here. You've got to get out of here. You've got to wait till he goes to base, and then you've got to get a check and get to New Bern, North Carolina, and fly home. But the second thing that came to my mind, and it's what stopped me for the next 12 and a half years, was, how will that look? You've been married 10 days and you're out, you're bailing out. How will that look? And see how things looked continued to be a roadblock in my life. And if I'm not careful, it can still be a roadblock in my recovery. So what I did that day is I just went back into that trailer and I just pretended like everything was all right. But that fear and that anxiety never left me until I found you. It never left me until I found you. We were married in January. I got pregnant in February. He got his orders for Vietnam in March. And by the end of April, I was back home in Cincinnati and I was thrilled. That's terrible. I was a bride, and I'm sending my husband off to Vietnam. I was just so relieved that he was gone. I just felt like if I had a year to figure it out, if I could just put it like under a microscope and figure it out, I'd be able to fix it. When I got home to Cincinnati, I called the priest that had married us, made an appointment to see him. As I was walking out the door of my parents' home, my mother said to me, I hope you're not going to tell him anything personal, because that's just how it was back then. So I went down to this priest, and I said to him, I don't know what's wrong. I can't put my finger on it, but something's not right. There's all this tension and anger and fear, and I don't know what to do about it. And he said to me, you know, you come from a long line of pretty aggressive women. Maybe you ought to learn to take a back seat in this marriage. Well, based on what I told him, I mean, that was the best advice he could give me back in 1970. But I knew, just as I knew from every place I would go looking for help until I found you, you know how you have that sinking feeling like you don't know what the answer is? But you're pretty sure that's not the answer? That's the way I always felt. And I went to a lot of places. I mean, I went to, we went to a marriage counselor once who told me to learn to speak in I statements. So I would come home and say, I hate you. I mean, just, you know, everywhere. Grabbing friends, grabbing people, you know, his sisters. I was very, very close to his sisters and still am today. And at that time, most of us smoked. I mean, I would just be on the phone with them, smoking a million cigarettes, of course, pregnant. Smoking cigarettes, and, you know, and what about his childhood? And why would he say that? What do you think made him do this? I mean, we were just like, you know, 90 miles an hour with our mouths going, our cigarettes, you know, just trying to figure it out. You know, something in his past. Certainly it must be something in his past. I'll bet it was his father. I mean, you know, just on and on and on. Just craziness. You know, somebody told me just a couple of weeks ago that if you put a butterfly in a jar, the butterfly just keeps flying in the same pattern over and over and over. And even when you take off the lid, that butterfly just keeps flying in the same pattern. And when I heard that, and it wasn't at a meeting, I thought, oh my God, that's what I did. I just kept flying in that same pattern over and over again. And even though the lid had come off, I just kept repeating the same things over and over. I mean, eventually you've got to take that jar really and just give it a hard knock and hit the thing out of it. So anyway, I never could figure it out. Went to all these different places. Went to a psychic one time. I mean, that was the craziest thing I did. And she's the one that said, I think there's help for your husband in the basement of a church. Not that I'd recommend it, but, you know, that's what happened. So he came back from Vietnam safely, and I always wanted to come back safely, God knows, but I always thought maybe if he'd been captured and tortured a little bit, he'd have a spiritual awakening. So he came back and decided to use the GI Bill and go to dental school at Ohio State. I always thought the guy was going to be a vet. I mean, when we were dating, when we were first married, he was going to be a vet. He was going to be a big animal vet. I don't know. Now he's going to be a dentist. But I went along with that. That was great. That was fine. Right before he left for dental school at Ohio State, he was beaten badly in a bar. He had to have surgery to correct a tear duct or something. And so at Ohio State, there was no drinking. And I thought it was because of me, because I had been so patient and tolerant, and I hadn't nagged, and see, those nuns were right, I'm thinking to myself. I just put in those early years, you know, all that time, and now, look, everything's going to be fine. There's no drinking, we're in this marriage group, and we're giving weekends to other couples, and everything's going to be fine, you know, it's just great. Got out of dental school, did well, he graduated cum laude, we started, we're having these kids. I mean, came back to Cincinnati and everything blew up. And I couldn't tell you what it was. All I knew was this, is that I started to become very, very nervous and anxious. And see, that's what I do. I start to lead my life with one foot out the door and one foot in the door. And you cannot conduct an intimate relationship like that. I one more time find myself gathering evidence, building a case. So if everything falls apart, I'm sure that you will know that it wasn't my fault. No, I'm the patient, loving one. He's the screw up. I'm the one that's following the rules. He's breaking all the rules. So what had happened was, in a nutshell, was that he, now that he had gotten his dental license, he also had a license to write prescriptions, and he was writing himself prescriptions for narcotics, and it wasn't long before he was caught by the Regional Enforcement Narcotic Unit and thrown out of dentistry. I was so relieved. I was so relieved because I thought, oh, thank God, he's just a drug addict. This is great. Because now he won't be able to, now that he's lost his license, he can't write prescriptions. Now we'll go back to being the loving couple I thought we were in Columbus. All is well. This is great. And as you know, it wasn't great at all. Because what happened then was we were plunged into years of unemployment. Unemployment and drink. And I'll tell you, as frightening as it is, the drink, unemployment for me, I mean, I grew up, you know, my grandparents, immigrants, I like to say, grew up in the shadow of the potato famine. I mean, we worked when we were little. I mean, we always worked, we saved, we worked, we gave the money to our parents. I mean, I came from a family that works. And now I'm married to a guy who not only is a jet pilot, a dentist, he isn't working. And we're living in a little house that his parents own on this family compound with the horses, and we can't even pay, we don't pay rent, we can't even pay our utility bill, and we got all these kids, and I am worried sick. I am worried sick. How are we going to feed these kids? And my second fear is, what if you find out? What if you find out what I'm living with? What will you think of me? It isn't fair to say he wasn't working at all. He became a fox hunter. And you know, really? Being a fur trapper is a lucrative profession in the 1780s, but in the 1980s, you don't make a lot of money. But my job was to package it. My job was to take it and to package it and to sell it to family and friends and make it seem like it was the most natural course of events. I would say to people, oh, dentistry, you know, he's far too exciting to be a dentist. He's just got that adventurous spirit about himself. No, he's an outdoors man. That's what he is. And he likes being out there with nature and tracking, you know, the fox and, you know, thinning out the population. God knows most of them are dying of what's that skin thing that animals get, you know, mange. Yeah, geez. I forgot my own story. And and so that's what I used to do. I mean, I used to always try to stay one step ahead, always try to make the rough road smooth, always try to keep the kids out of his way. Never thought of myself as a controlling person, but what I found myself doing was always trying to control the environment, always trying to control the situation so he would not blow up. Always go to a party, and when we were there, I'd try to stay behind him and warn you off from touchy subjects with eye contact. Always paid attention to how much he was drinking, because the more he drank, the quieter I would become. I mean, I was just so in charge, or at least I thought I was always in charge. I felt like I had to be just vigilant. I was just vigilant. He also would hunt birds. I mean, he loved birds, but there were some birds he didn't like. And so, because he was so talented, in addition to the fox hunting, he also would, he had all these bird feeders. Outside of our house was this huge oak tree. And right outside of our bedroom window, you know, he would have suet nailed up to the tree, and he would watch his, and all this thistle seed for goldfinch. He was just so talented. He was so talented. But he also was a marksman trained by the United States Marine Corps, and he would sleep with a rifle up against our bed and on his side. And he would sleep with the window open, and God forbid a blue jay would come near the suet or anything. He would reach behind and grab that gun and just blow the hell out of any bird that he didn't want eating his bird seed. I mean, it was, so what I would do, you see, I would, that would be my key to jump into action. So I would run down the steps and say to the little kids, "Don't play on this side of the house today. Dad's hunting. Take your little buddies and move them over to where the hummingbirds live." And you know, just all that trying to stay on top of things. And we had these encroaching suburbs that were moving in on this family compound. And these people now don't want their kids to play with my children because of the steel leg hold traps. And, you know, I used to take that. They don't hurt you much. You just open them up and release the child. That's all you do. Set them free. Go home to your mother. I'm sure she has plenty of bandages. But see, this is what happens. In order for me to try to make this seem normal, I have to adjust my thinking. I have to adjust my thinking so that it is normal. And so the insanity that is so much a part of alcoholism, it really just invades the whole family. When I used to teach high school, I used to run this little group for kids from alcoholic homes, and, you know, we talk about alcoholism being a disease like diabetes. It's a disease like, you know, this or that. And I used to have this little teenage girl in the group that used to say, "I hate when you say that." I said, "Well, what would you say?" She said, "I think alcoholism is a disease like rabies." Well, that might be even more appropriate, actually, because, you know, for me, it was always that constant trying to cover things up, trying to stay one step ahead, trying to reinterpret my children's experience for them. "No, no, 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 that's not what Dad said. No, 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 that's not what Dad did," and to twist it and turn it and try to make it something that I as their mother could live with. And then we have these neighbors, of course, too, who not only are complaining about the steel leg hold traps, but they're missing their house pets. It's the cats that did me in, because I happen to like cats. But once he got a pair of infrared glasses, I knew those house cats that were feeding at night on the pheasant and quail in our fields, they weren't going to make it. He would say, if they're fat cats, they're just killing to kill. If they're scrawny cats, I always let them live. So then I would think, fat cat, you've got to die. Scrawny cat, you can live. I mean, it's, but eventually what happens, I wouldn't even answer the phone anymore because it got to be too much. It got to be too much to take that phone call and lie about it. Say I really hadn't seen Boots. I really didn't think she'd been up that way. When I knew Boots was probably somewhere in the fields, you know, in 1,000 pieces. So it was, that's, you know, that what happens is that alcoholism led me into a type of isolation because it was too much for me to be in community. And that's one of the greatest gifts Al-Anon gave back to me, is that presence in a community one more time with men and women who understood. Men and women understood, as we say in our literature, as too few can. In a nutshell, what happened was one of the sisters who lived on the driveway joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and then another sister joined AA, then another sister joined AA, then another sister joined AA. And pretty soon, I mean, within a month's time, I have 4 sister-in-laws now who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and still are today. And those who were married, their husbands were joining Al-Anon. And I lived in the little house on the family compound up by the pool. And so, and I was in charge of keeping it clean. So they would come up all, you know, summer long and bring their big books with them, and they would talk about alcoholism being a family disease. They would talk about how it affected their family and had affected their family for years. And I knew what they wanted. I mean, I knew they were gently trying to coax me into Al-Anon, but, you know, I just did not want to go. I just was 12 and a half years out. I was shot. I was just done. I was exhausted. I was exhausted trying to keep the lid on something that I couldn't keep the lid on. I was exhausted from what it felt like to me living with a live grenade and always trying to find the pin and put the pin back in before it blew up and hurt a lot of people. I was just tired. But I'll tell you, the idea of it being a family disease was enough, created enough fear in me that I decided that I should get to a meeting. When I went to my first meeting, I was pregnant with our 7th child, and I knew that I would never know another quiet moment if indeed this thing ran in families. And so I went to an Al-Anon meeting on April 5th, 1982, and I went to a meeting that was way far out from where I live because God knows I didn't want anybody to think that I needed help. And I certainly didn't want, I mean, I'm just not big on group things, you know. But I thought, what the heck? I mean, I'm going to have to do something here. He was 4 years older than I am. Women generally outlive men by about 4 years. And I thought, I always had this idea of an 8-year plan at the end of my life. And if this is true, that alcoholism is a family disease and we've got all these kids, there goes my 8-year plan right out the window. So I went to a meeting. And while I was there, you know, it was run by this older woman. Her name was Ruth. And I said to her, I don't know if my husband's an alcoholic or not. I truly don't. He doesn't seem to drink like my idea of an alcoholic drinks. And she said, well, let me ask you this. Has his drinking ever been a problem in your life? And I said to her, well, let me tell you this. Every time he drinks, it's a problem because somebody gets hurt. Somebody gets hurt. She said, well, then you're in the right place because Al-Anon is a program for you. It's a program for you. Now, that's what I heard at my very first meeting, and that's the message that I have to hold on to as I continue this process of recovery. Al-Anon is a program for me. It doesn't really matter what anybody else in my life is doing. She's the one, and you then backed her up, told me of the importance of taking my husband and placing him with a power that was greater than myself while I went about the job of recovering from the family disease of alcoholism. That's what I heard. She said alcoholism is a disease that you didn't cause, you can't cure, and you can't control. I never thought I caused it, never. But I always thought if I were patient enough, loving enough, loyal enough, I'd be able to cure it. and when I couldn't, what I would say to him was never anything compared to the things that I used to say to myself. I can remember going out, you know, outside of this family compound up on a hill that overlooked the Ohio River and the hills of Kentucky, and looking up into the sky and saying to the God of my understanding, who, and I was raised with a compassionate and loving God, and saying, you know, it's all right with me if this is going to be my life. I mean, I had a great 21 years in the beginning. And if the rest is supposed to be heartache and hardship, okay. But I cannot believe that this is your will for these little kids. I can't believe that the God that I know and have experienced would want suffering for these innocents. And that's the piece that used to always get me. I just couldn't make sense of it. And now I'm with this woman that's telling me, this is really none of your, that's none of your business. You've got to start paying attention to your actions, to your attitudes. We got to get you better. You can recover from this. Because you see, honestly, I had been hollowed out. That's what alcoholism did. It just hollowed me out. It took from me my spontaneity. It took from me my good humor. It took from me my hopes, my dreams for the future. And it took from me, really, what it will always demand, my dignity as a human being. I mean, I was shot when I came in that door. And now I've got this little old woman with gray hair giving me something nobody, I didn't know. It's not your business. What is your business is for you to recover. That's what your business is. So I started going to meetings, and I could not get enough of your good news. I couldn't get enough of that, you know, let go and let God. I loved that one. Let go and let God. I would go home, and, you know, he would say, where are the diapers? Did you do the diapers? No, I let go and let God. I don't even know where the diapers are. Does that kid even have diapers on? Thank God we live in the country. You know, I mean, I loved it. I loved it. I have a little, you could be right. Oh, you could be right. I loved that one too. So, you know, I would go to these meetings and I would come home and he would say, oh, I guess my sisters have you. And I'd say, I don't know, you know, you could be right. Now you're just going to get crazy with this recovery talk. Oh, I don't know, you could be right. I mean, I just said that, whoa, I just said that to everything. And I wasn't doing it really as a smart-aleck response. It was just that you were teaching me that wonderful stance of, well, it's just such a stance of freedom, not to have to know, not to have to have everybody's answers. It was great. And, you know, really, it continues to be great. As long as I can live believing, as my sponsor says, that God will sort it out. I have the same sponsor today as I did when I came in 82. That's it's like her mantra. Kathy, God will sort it out. Let God sort it out. Wow, what good news. I mean, I know a lot of people that come into Al-Anon and they'll say, oh, my first year was so difficult and it was so hard. Not me. That first night, I could have done cartwheels out to my car. It was the first time I ever realized or anybody had intimated to me that this wasn't my job, that I didn't have to, you know, fix and make it right and create. No, I just had to start to take a look at me, my own actions, my attitudes. It was terrific. It was wonderful. I began to rely on the wisdom of the group. I learned so many things from you, and you made so many promises to me. That whole idea of turning everything over, my life, my will, to the care of God. My mother has had and has today this little prayer in her refrigerator that says, reach up as high as you can, and God will reach down the rest of the way. That's the kind of things that you gave to me. That's the kind of faith that you shared with me. Little nun I met out in California not so long ago, she said to me once, you know, I don't say let go and let God. I just go like this. And, you know, I love that image of just, but you know, just doing the, and it's not doing anything. It's taking action and letting go of the results. That's what you've taught me to do over and over again. But really, nothing changed for me until I had that sponsor, until I did a fourth step, until I started to look how much my own actions and my attitudes were part and parcel of this mess that we had in our home. Because I'm not big on confronting, particularly people that I consider to be dangerous. I'm not big on confronting those kinds of people. I just kind of keep my mouth shut, and then I erase them as human beings. I don't deal with them. I ignore them. And really, the way I was raised, it would be kinder to fight than just to be indifferent. But I had just become indifferent. I had just built a wall to keep myself safe that I was unwilling to let him breach. And when I had to look at all these things in a fourth step, I mean, for 12 and a half years, I'd been asking the wrong questions. What's wrong with him? Why would he do that? Why would he say that? And now I have to apply those questions to myself. Why did I do that? Why would I say that? And go through all those things that you taught me fearlessly, thoroughly, and share them with another human being. That's when things changed for me, when I knew that I was really serious about this process of recovery. We say in our literature, if we willingly surrender to the discipline of these steps, our lives will be transformed. That's what you told me, and that's what happened. And in sharing that with my sponsor, you know, so many times she would say to me, Kathy, lay that at the feet of alcoholism. Lay that at the feet of alcoholism. It's how it works in families. It's how it, you know, it's insidious. And this is, you know, this is where I learned forgiveness of others, of self, and of the world. I hadn't been in Al-Anon very long before my husband was killed in a helicopter crash. It was an experimental aircraft that he had built himself. And one beautiful day, he walked out the door, as he often did, to fly. And he would leave, and I would be resentful and angry because I was stuck with all these kids hanging all over me. But that had changed because you had said to me, does he get any peace from that flight? And I'd say, you know, it's probably the only peace he has. And you said, well, why would you want to take that away from him? And, you know, my attitude about it changed. So on that particular day that he left, my last words to him were, wow, you have a beautiful day to fly. Have a ball. That's what I owe Al-Anon. That's what I owe the men and women that very gently walked me through. Have a ball. Because I know this, that even though, unlike his four sisters and now today a brother, five members of his immediate family who are in AA, it eluded him. It just, for whatever reason, he tried you scared him. And he just, you know, he just decided to do it a different way. But I know today he's in the arms of a loving and compassionate God. And that peace and serenity that he didn't get here, he has now. And, you know, that's enough for me. That's enough for me. Because I work with a sponsor who tells me what's really important is to learn to live with the questions, that I don't have to know the answers. I don't need to know the answers. I just need to take the next right action. When my husband died, it was 1985. We had seven children, and the oldest one was 14. And I knew, well, we had both known before he died, that some of the older ones were already into drugs and alcohol. And so for the next 20 years, from 85 to 2005, to that last little kid graduated from college, those next 20 years, my focus really was being the best mother that I knew how to be. my kids, I don't know what to say about them. I just love them to death, every one of them, all seven of them. They're delightful. But they just are all really adventurous. And they're very spirited, if you know what I mean. They're very, very spirited, and you know, they've gotten into a lot of trouble. Not usually at the same time, but God knows, I mean, some of our best vacations have been visiting one or the other in rehab. Not so long ago, one of my sons had a girlfriend over, and there's a picture that I have of myself and the kids, and it's taken out in Montana, and it's a beautiful shot. You know, we'd just gone through this flat tire up in the mountains. We're all from the city. We don't know what to do. I mean, we're stuck up in the mountains. No gasoline, of course, because I misjudged the distance. Flat tire. Nobody has any water or anything. I mean, it was just a disaster. But we made it out alive, and we finally got down from the mountain. We're all filled with mud, but this just great picture of us, you know, all by this raging river. And this one kid's girlfriend said, "Wow, that's a wonderful picture. Where was that taken?" And he goes, "Oh, that picture? That's when we went to visit my brother in rehab." And she's like, "Oh." So then there's another picture where different rehab. And she goes, wow, you must like mountains a lot. Where's that picture taken?" He goes, "Well, that's when we went to visit my brother in the state of Washington when he was in rehab." And she went, "Wow." Anyway, we never seen her since. But anyway, but this is the thing. The thing is this, is that you've taught me every step of the way. Most powerful amends I could make to my kids was to give them a healthy parent. You have told me that time and time again, that the most powerful amends I could make to them is to give them a healthy parent. And I believe that to be as true today when they're adults as I did when they were kids and getting into a lot of trouble. One of the things that you taught me when they were teenagers and, oh my gosh, you know, after he died, I had to get a job and all I had was this expired elementary education certificate. And, you know, we talk about miracles this weekend. Really, he died in May. In July, this Marianist brother that I had never met called me and said, "I understand you might need a job." I said, "Well, I do need a job, but I don't have a high school certificate." "We don't care." I said, "Well, I just have this expired." "That's okay. We'll give you everything. We'll give you all your insurance that you need. We'll just give you everything. Just come and start in August." And I said, "Well, I've got all these little kids who aren't even school yet." "Oh, that's okay. We'll find a place for them. Just come and teach." Now, they can't do that today, I don't think. But in 85, they did it. And that's what happened. And so I got in this wonderful high school in the city, surrounded, you know, by all these wonderful men and women. You know, I taught religion. Really, it's crazy. I taught a course in ethics and morality and social justice to high school kids. And when I was getting my degree in teaching, I used to say to my professors, "I'll teach anything, but the only group I don't want to teach is high school kids." And you know what? Big surprise. I love high school kids. They're hilarious. I think they're the funniest demographic in the country. They're delightful because when you teach high school kids, every day you go in there, they act exactly how you would expect high school kids to act. They're so predictable. They never do what they're supposed to do. They always talk back, but they're hilarious. And I know people that work with adults who never act like adults. How frustrating that must be. You know? So I'm in a great place, and what better place for a single mother to learn how to raise kids, particularly during those dangerous years, is to surround her all day long with high school kids. It was terrific. I would ground my kids, and then some goofball would say to me, "Hey, I saw your daughter on the street Friday night." And I'd say, "Really? Well, that's interesting." I'd go home, and I'd say to her, "Didn't I ground you on Friday night? Would you sneak out the window?" "How did you know?" I said, "Because you were seen on Erie Avenue. You're grounded for another 2 weeks. I hate that you teach high school." I mean, I can't tell you the miracles. I can't tell you the miracles. Honest to God, it is great. It was great. I was in juvenile court really so many times that the referee adopted a child from China as a single woman. And the people she worked with had a big shower for her. I was invited. I was invited. That's how well I knew her. And I loved her. She was fair and just and You taught me to cooperate. I cooperated with Hamilton County. I cooperated with Cincinnati Police. My kids hated the fact that I would never get them a lawyer. But, you know, I always showed up with them because that's what you told me to do. I cooperated. What can I do? How can we make this better? But all along the way, I knew this, that I was powerless over the disease of alcoholism. I was powerless over the disease. And one time, this wonderful woman from AA said to me, you know, the secret with kids and drinking is this. All you can do is try your best to interrupt their drinking and hope to God they live long enough to get an Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's all I would do. Instead of taking on this burden of feeling like I had to get all those kids into recovery, just one day at a time, I would take appropriate action as a parent and hope to God they would stay alive long enough to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Out of my seven kids, I have seen three come into AA. I've seen one who continues to go to AA. I have one that says, you know, Mom, I just really think that I was brainwashed, and I just simply say to him, you could be right. You could be right. I don't know. I really don't. I'm not a diagnostician. It's not my job to diagnose the disease. I don't know. I know one thing. I have been profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism, and so I continue to keep coming back. And I know that in the women that I sponsor, what we do is we pay very, very close attention to our own actions, our own behaviors, those daily inventories that we take. How am I being the woman that I believe God created me to be? How am I being the woman that I believe that God challenges me to be each day? That's what I have to look at. I have to look at me. And I have one son that has simply said to me, I'm just not done drinking. I'm just not done drinking. I said to him not so long ago, you know, when he lost another relationship, you know, the only tool that she has in her toolbox really is your drinking. And he said, you know, Mom, I told her, I'm not drinking anymore. And you know, I didn't want to break out into this big smile. So I just tried to be calm and I said, really? You're not drinking anymore? He said, no, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not drinking any less, but I'm not drinking anymore. Anyway, I have another one that I am concerned about his drinking. It gets him in a lot of trouble, too. And I said to him, you know, I am concerned about your drinking. He always says, it's not a problem. It's a hobby. They're so funny, those kids. Anyhow, you know, one time when I took him to a counselor, I said to this counselor, you know, I just don't know that I can raise all these kids alone by myself. And he said, oh, you can't. And I said, I can't? He said, oh, no, you're understaffed. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I have learned to hold on to. Those kinds of, I have a woman in my group that talks about the importance of shepherding, you know, shepherding your thoughts, because I'm an A to Z person. I mean, I go, here's A, I'm at Z that quickly. I have a son that, God willing, will return from his second tour in Iraq next Wednesday. But I'll tell you, when I, well, what can he do? The unfortunate thing is he'll be home for 11 months and then they'll send him back to Afghanistan. I mean, it's just the way that it is. He's a helicopter pilot. And I just have to, when he's over there, I just have to really shepherd my thoughts. I mean, I could torture myself, but when I hear there's a helicopter down, you know, it just does something to me. I don't know. I mean, it just, I don't know if you ever felt like somebody set your hair on fire, but... And all I know to do is just to go and go to a meeting and to know that what you've taught me, that no matter what happens, I never have to go through any of this alone. You see, that's really where so much of our, I think so many of our, some, for so many of us, our strength comes from, knowing that we never have to go through things alone. I go to meetings with men and women who have buried their children as a result of this disease, and yet they continue to show up and to be of service and to live lives of grace and dignity and deep compassion. I would never have to walk through anything like that alone. I know that. I also know it would never be an easy thing. But all along the way, you have been there for me. From the very first time I had to sign a complaint against one of my kids for incorrigibility, you showed up and met me there at juvenile court, showed me where the papers were, what to fill out where. And then when the next woman called me, I met her, showed her where the papers were, how to file, you know, what to file, where to put it. Because that's what we do for one another. We walk together down this road. And really, despite the grief and despite the heartache, there is a tremendous amount of joy and freedom and miracles all along the way. All along the way. Because all of us, I believe, had been invited into this intimate relationship with the God of our understanding. I got my invitation through the disease of alcoholism. And I have no argument with that, because that's what got me. I don't think I ever would have launched myself down this path, this spiritual path, unless something like this got my attention. And believe me, it got my attention. Alcoholism broke my heart, but the hand of God got into that deep wound, and I have known nothing really but healing ever since. That lovely guy that I was dating in college from Indianapolis came back into my life in the 90s. And in 2005, when that last child of mine graduated from college, 3 weeks later, he and I got married. And let me tell you, you want to talk about a miracle. He'd never been married before, and he didn't have any children. That's what I call a double winner. So when one of my kids, you know, the interesting thing was when I was teaching in that high school, the guidance counselor said to me one time, do you know if your husband, your late husband, if he served in the military during war, all your children are eligible for free tuition at any state college in the state of Ohio. It's called a War Orphan Scholarship. And do you know that every one of those kids had free tuition to every one of them? And Ohio has wonderful state schools. Ohio State University, University of Cincinnati, Miami University of Ohio, every one of them got a free ride as a result of their father's service during Vietnam in the Marine Corps. Yeah, it's really, I mean, to tell you the truth, it has been one miracle, really one miracle after another. One miracle after another. And I want to tell you, when this last kid who turned down the scholarship because she won a scholarship at St. Louis University, when she was graduating, the commencement speaker was running late. And when she finally got there, she said, sorry I was so late, but I have a six-year-old that just learned the Lord's Prayer, and he was insistent that I listened to him before I left. And she said, he stood before me and he said, our Father who art in heaven, how'd you know my name? And you know, when I heard that, I thought to myself, there's the program of Al-Anon for me. There it is in a nutshell. Because what it has done for me and continues to do for me one day at a time is it has reintroduced me to and put me back into a relationship with a God who truly knows my name. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.